Good day, citizens of the free world. From border to border, coast to coast, and to all the ships at sea, I bring you a warm welcome. This is your correspondent, Jim Tate, and thank you for tuning in to the Tate Chronicles. Joining me as we cut through the fog that exists at the leading edge of healthcare technologies, our mission is simple. We're searching for information about beneficial disruption in healthcare from emerging technologies. My guest today is James Gatto. Jim is a partner at the law firm of Shepherd Mullin, is based in Washington, D.C. He's a partner in the Intellectual Property Practice Group and also the team leader of the firm's blockchain technology and digital currency team, as well as the firm's open source team. I met Jim at the recent HIMSS conference and wanted to bring his observations to our audience. Jim, welcome to the Tate Chronicles.
Thank you, Jim. Pleasure to be here.
You know, a lot of the folks that I interview and talk with come from a background of pure healthcare or pure technology, but it's a rare opportunity to talk to somebody who's involved with these new technologies, who's can kind of bring a legal view to some of these kind of things. And I know you've been involved with intellectual property law for quite some time. How did you get involved with the legal aspects of blockchain technology and the digital currency issues?
Yeah, so it was kind of a long road, but I'll kind of make it brief as much as possible. So I studied undergraduate electrical engineering and physics, so I always had a technology background. And instead of working as an engineer right out of college, I actually went into the patent office, worked as a patent examiner, and went to law school at night at Georgetown here in D.C. And that was back in 1984, and I've been doing intellectual property work ever since. As part of the work that I've done in the intellectual property field, most of it is focused on software and internet-related work. And one of the things that I've really tried to do to distinguish my career is I've always had a passion for the intersection of business law and technology. And I kind of quickly learned that anytime you have new business models and new technology, A, there's always going to be more new IP issues, and there's going to be other legal issues as well. So just from a passion perspective, as well as for purposes of business development, I've always sought out areas of cutting-edge technology and business models to apply my trade to. And one of the areas I got involved with several years ago was video games. And as video games evolved from, you know, buying packaged software in a retail store and putting the software into a console, to online and having free-to-play games where the way they were monetized was people bought virtual currency that were used to buy virtual items in the game, I became pretty proficient in advising game companies on virtual currency issues. And as an outgrowth of that, as cryptocurrencies and other forms of digital currencies emerged, I kind of stayed abreast of those and kind of evolved with that. And of course, one of the early applications of that was Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is one of the leading digital currency by market cap. And the technology that's used to support Bitcoin is the blockchain technology. So that's how I ended up there.
You know, well, I'm fascinated, and we'll get into details of blockchain technology, but let's talk about the digital currencies that run on top of blockchain technology. There seems to be pretty much an ongoing debate as to whether digital currencies or cryptocurrencies are a new asset class, or if this is just some Dutch tulip bubble that's all going to go away in the next 3 to 5 years. What is this, a new asset class? Are these here to stay?
Yes. In my opinion, there are a number of very useful, significant, and valuable digital currencies. There are a number that are Dutch tulip bulbs. So if you look at the digital currency market over the last several years, there's several thousand digital currencies that have been created. Most of them, in my opinion, were ill-conceived and somewhat useless. And if you go to a website called deadcoins.com, you can see how many died a quick death. Having said that, there are a number that are, I think, very useful and will continue to persist. And I think that if you want to break down real quick, there's different categories of digital currencies and why they're useful. So if you look at ones that are pure digital currencies like Bitcoin, it's kind of a universal digital currency. By that, I mean it's not tied to a particular platform or a particular service. Anyone is free to use it with anyone else who's willing to accept it. And it can be used as a simple example. If you want to send money from the U.S. to some, let's say, third world country, instead of going through one of the money transmission services where you may pay 10 or 15% fee to transfer the funds, you can use Bitcoin, and it's borderless. It's relatively inexpensive, almost free, not quite, to use. The other kind of major category or two categories of digital currencies are application-specific and then platform currencies. So by application-specific, I mean there are a number of specific blockchain-based applications where that application has its own currency that's used for payment within that application. Then there's platform currency. So if you think of things like Ethereum, Ethereum is a platform on which developers can build various applications. And there is a digital currency called Ether. And in order to have transactions processed on the Ethereum platform, you have to pay what is referred to as gas, which is the charge for validating transactions, and you have to pay for that in Ether. So if you're operating on that platform, there's a need to use that currency. And so for application-specific and platform currencies, as those applications, or if those applications become widely used, or if the platforms become widely used, then there's a demand and a need for those currencies, and that's what would provide an inherent value to those currencies.
That's a great synopsis, Jim. I kind of think of Bitcoin as being a noun, and Ether is more of a verb, because you need Ether to do transactions, although some people certainly buy and sell it and hold it because it is a type of commodity, whereas Bitcoin is a pure commodity, if that's the right word for it. And I do, well, first let me say I don't own any Bitcoin, so my comments aren't based on where the price of it goes. But I think Bitcoin has no comparators in terms of what it is and what it does. There's no collateral requirements around it. It is truly digital currency. So, and it's over 10 years old now and has stood the test of time. What type of clients do you serve in these domains? Are they folks that are trying to figure out how they can maybe do an initial coin offering or privacy issues? What type of clients do you work with in these areas, Jim?
We represent clients of all types that are in different parts of the ecosystem. So, I'd say that, kind of for an analogy for people to understand, blockchain and digital currency, in my opinion, is very similar and analogous in many ways to the evolution of the Internet and the different companies that were there. So when you think about the Internet, there were a lot of companies that were Internet technology and service providers. They provided the so-called picks and acts for the Internet gold rush. Companies like Netscape that made browsers, you had AOL that provided network access, etc. The same is true with blockchain. There are companies that are building out the infrastructure and the tools and services necessary to enable applications to be useful and easy to use. You have companies that are building out applications, and then you have a whole set of companies that are using those technology and services for their customers. And we represent people all along that food chain.
You know, one of the things I noticed at HIMSS this year was, and I was there a year ago when there was a lot of certainly talk and conversation about blockchain in health information technology, but not much to see. But this year I saw the arrival of some real tools to build upon, so you didn't have to necessarily build a blockchain from scratch. There's some tools that allow you to take an idea you may have that would benefit from the underlying blockchain technology and quickly develop a blockchain and create nodes and permissions and test out ideas. So it was good to see in a 12-month period really the arrival of some tools, just like you're talking about there. And one other thing that's kind of fascinating to watch, it, since you mentioned internet, we saw the first real browser from Netscape, and they own the world as far as browsers. And then within a few years, they had disappeared. I don't even know if you do a Netscape browser anymore. I imagine the same thing is going to happen moving forward with all these collateral industries that are around blockchain technology. One thing that kind of has fascinated me about the Ethereum platform, which is a, some people call it blockchain 2.0, because it introduced the concept of smart contracts. So there could be computer code in the blockchain, which said if a certain action takes place, then another action would take place. Sounds like a contract to me. If you do this, if you see this patient and do an x-ray, then I'll release money to you. There's a thousand different ways that these smart contracts could be utilized. But when I hear the word contracts, that kind of sounds legal to me. So are these smart contracts any different from a written contract? I mean, what are your thoughts around these smart contracts from a legal viewpoint?
Yeah, I think the term smart contract is actually an unfortunate choice of words. And in fact, the individual who coined that term, Nick Szabo, has kind of acknowledged that. But not to diminish his creative and foresightful thinking around the concept. So let me kind of break that down. Smart contracts are not necessarily legal contracts. In some cases, they can be. So what they are is code that implements some or all of the operational or business logic of an agreement between two or more parties. So when we think about that, a good analogy is automatic bill pay, for example. If I agree that you can take money out of my account on the first day of the month to pay some loan that I have, there's typically a written agreement that will govern that service. And then there's code that actually implements it. That's not necessarily a smart contract. That's how that works. And so I think in most cases with smart contracts, you'll have a similar thing. You'll have a written agreement, and it'll be code that implements some or all of it. So what makes a smart contract different than automatic bill pay? So one of the big differences is that the smart contract is implemented, the code for the smart contract is implemented on a blockchain, and there's various characteristics then that become relevant to that. The smart contract can exist on multiple nodes or computers in the network. The transactions can be validated by different entities, not just a single entity. There's various, kind of blockchain-specific features that become relevant when you put a smart contract code on a blockchain. But one of the other things that I think is very different in and will apply in many, not necessarily all, but many smart contracts, is that the problem with bill pay is if I tell you can take money out of my account on the first of the month and the money is not there, you have to go through traditional legal channels to get that money. There's the legal process. You may have to go to court. You may have to get a judgment. You may have to enforce the judgment. One of the characteristics of smart contracts is that you can have a self-adjudicating default mechanism built into the code. So what does that mean? So if, for example, there's a smart contract and I agree to pay you a certain amount of money every month, if for some reason I default on that payment, you could program it such that if that occurs, something else happens. So for example, I could have something in digital escrow. And if the default occurs, that escrow can be released and that item can be transferred directly to you without having to go through judges, juries, and lawyers. That's an overly simplistic explanation of it, but that concept of having this default mechanism built into the code, I think is going to be a powerful feature of smart contracts in many situations.
One of my favorite comments from Mark Twain, Jim, is when he said everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it. And I kind of think of that somewhat about smart contracts. Everybody's talking about smart contracts, but nobody's doing much about it, in that they're really in their infancy. And so one of the questions from a legal aspect I would have is, you know, some folks say, well, it shouldn't be called a smart contract. It should just be called a dumb contract, because it's really simple. It's if this happens, then that happens. If that doesn't happen, then this will happen. It's really just, you know, it's logic and it's computer code, or logic written in this computer code. But in the complex smart contract that might be written for a hospital to reimburse a insurance company based on certain procedures being done, things like that, there has to be some assurance that that contract is, balance is not the right word, but is accurate. And I know we've seen the rise of some companies that audit smart contracts to make sure that that what is intended will happen will actually happen. And we've seen some problems with smart contracts. Recent rollout a couple of months ago of the latest version of Ethereum was held off because of some smart contract issues. What's happening with smart contracts in terms of being valid or verifiable? I don't mean legally valid, but just verifiable that it's really understood. I mean, if you had a smart contract, you've got to be looking at the code and have somebody on your team, I would imagine, who really understands what the code is as well as what the law is.
Yeah, no, that's all true. And so on kind of two parts to the answer of what you just said, as far as, you know, is anyone using them? I mean, they're starting to gain adoption. I wouldn't say there's widespread use yet. But yeah, they are conditional logic. There's, you know, and in many cases you'll have, you know, a chain of smart contracts where the output of one feeds the input of another. I'll give you a quick example of where they're being used, where I think it's relevant is when you think about cold chain storage. So if you have pharmaceuticals or produce or other types of things that need to be shipped in a temperature controlled environment, you can have a Internet of Things, a sensor that's attached to the shipping container that can record the temperature all along the delivery route and write that temperature to a blockchain. And when that shipping container arrives at a facility, there can be a smart contract that actually goes and it's programmed to read the data, the sensor data, to see if the temperature was proper along the entire chain. And if it is, then it can pass on to the next step as far as what needs to be done to accept that shipment. But if it's not, it can reject it right then and there and send out notice of rejection. So that's an example of where the smart contract is not itself a full contract, but it performs one operational feature of what might otherwise be a contract that specifies, you know, you have to, you know, have, you know, maintain the temperature at a proper temperature for me to accept delivery. So simple example, but you can see how that can then maybe feed into another smart contract that might check some other aspect of the delivery. So that's the part about, you know, is there usage or kind of what they are and et cetera. From the standpoint of checking the code, you're 100% right. I mean, it is software, and whether it's smart contract or any other software, if you are relying on code for some aspect of your business, whether, you know, someone is developing code for you or you're agreeing to adopt code, you want to check it. You want to make sure it does what you intended to do. It's very similar to if I ask you to develop code for me and you deliver it to me, I'm gonna check that code and make sure that I believe it works properly according to the functional spec that we wrote, and that, you know, it's got ease of use and no bugs or et cetera. But it is important as part of the use of smart contracts where there's multiple parties who are relying on it. Each party does want to ensure that they've reviewed the code and they believe it implements what the intended business logic is that smart contract is encoding.
Are you seeing, in terms of the legal profession, more and more conferences and continuing education around issues of blockchain technology and smart contracts?
Absolutely. There's a conference or webinar or seminar every day. I speak at a lot of them. I could probably talk at a conference every day and still have to turn some down.
Yeah, it's amazing the amount of education that's being really launched and pulled out. That kind of brings me to another question. One thing that's fascinating to me about watching blockchain technology come is that if you mention it in casual conversation or you're having dinner with somebody and it comes up, a lot of folks say, well, what is it? And that's because it's been talked about. It's in the media so much. And, you know, nobody ever asks me anymore, well, how does email work? But they will say, oh, what's this blockchain business that everybody's talking about? How do you respond when people ask you that?
It's a good question and a good observation. I think many people don't dig into it. Many people focus on the currency side because that's what's been in the news is, you know, the run-up and then the drop-off in price of a lot of the currencies where, you know, there were ICOs, et cetera, and that's what's captured people's attention. For people who ask about what blockchain technology is, I try to give them a relatively simple explanation. The first part of the answer is that there's many different types of blockchains. There is not just one blockchain. There's public blockchains, there's private blockchains, and they serve different roles. But one of the kind of the core things, the reason the term blockchain is used is that it literally is a chain of blocks when you think about it at its fundamental. And what that means is an alternative term that's used is distributed ledger technology, and they're not quite interchangeable, but blockchain can be a type of distributed ledger. And so we think about a ledger, you know, in the old days it was a book with paper and you wrote on each line of a page a transaction and the transaction data. When the page got full, you went to the next page. But with blockchain, it's essentially tracking transactions, processing and tracking transactions, and you write transaction data to a block. And a block is just a set of memory, a certain amount of memory that's allocated to hold a certain amount of transaction data. And when you fill the block, you create a new block. And what chains them together and what part of what provides the fundamental security and validity of blockchain data is that when a block gets full, you create what's called a hash value. And in simple terms, a hash is there's an algorithm that's run based on the contents of the block. And every set of unique content will create a unique hash value. It's a very long alphanumeric string of characters that represents the value. And that hash value from block one gets written to block two. And so because you're linking the hash value of one block to the next, that's what is chaining the blocks together. And what happens then is if anyone ever tries to go back and change the values or any of the content in block one, it'll generate a new hash value and it won't match with the original hash value that's written to block two. And so in this way, this is one of the ways, rather, in which blockchain data becomes immutable, meaning it can't be changed or it can't be changed validly. The second way is that with blockchain is that you don't just create a single copy of the blockchain, but rather in most blockchain networks, once that block is written and validated by one of the nodes or one or more of the nodes, then that chain gets written to many different locations that are under control of several different parties. And that's where you get this concept of it being a distributed technology. So it's not just in one place. There's no single point of failure. There's no single entity that controls it. So it's decentralized. There's not a central control. And through this combination of features, you end up with a network where the data resides on multiple nodes under control of multiple parties and it can't be changed. Very different than if you have a central location or a central entity that controls it where someone with admin rights can go into a database and change a transaction. So it's a completely different paradigm of trusting the network as opposed to trusting an entity.
You know, in that last sentence, I'm sorry to interrupt you, were you going to say something else?
Nope, that was it.
Yeah. You know, and where the trust is really sourced to computer code, to the network. You just saved a lot of us going to a two-day conference, Jim, with that three-minute explanation.
I try to be efficient.
Well, it was really, we're almost totally out of time here. I can't believe it. How can someone contact you, reach out to you, have you come speak to their group? How can someone get in touch with you, Jim?
Sure. So you can reach me. My email is just jgatto@shepherdmullen.com, or you can find me on LinkedIn. If you just type in James Gatto and blockchain, you'll find me. And I'd be happy to have conversations with people who are interested in the space, just to share intellectual knowledge, or if people are interested in having legal services done, I'm happy to talk to you about that as well. And yes, we do frequently speak at conferences, and we have to be selective because there's, as I mentioned earlier, there's more opportunities than there is time to do that. One other thing I would just mention as a potential service to your listeners, we do have a blog where we cover a lot of really interesting topics in this field. It's called Law of the Ledger. If you want, you can subscribe to that, and you'll get access to our blog for free, and you'll get timely updates on a lot of the interesting things that are going on in the space.
Well, great. Well, thanks so much for that. And to our audience, thanks for joining me on this episode of the Tate Chronicles. I offer a special salute to my guest, James Gatto. Jim, thanks for coming aboard today.
My pleasure. It's been enjoyable.
You can find more information on this show's program page at healthcarenowradio.com. Until we meet again, here's wishing you smooth sailing and safe harbors.